This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When the Cannon Mills textile plant closed in Kannapolis in 2003, it was the single largest one-day layoff in the state's history. More than 4,300 people lost their jobs. At the time, the town seemed destined for collapse. But an infusion of cash from a California billionaire and the development of the biotech research industry has offered hope to many residents of Kannapolis. The progress, of course, is not without controversy, as citizens sell their genetic samples to biobanks. Some question the ethics of the research. Reporter Amanda Wilson covered the story, and her work is featured in the Pacific Standard. She joins us now. Hello, Amanda.
Hi.
Good to talk with you. Tell us about the history of the Cannon Mills plant, Kannapolis.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And just to clarify, people aren't really selling their genetic information. They're participating as research participants. So what they receive for their participation is considered compensation for their time. And there's one biobank there at this time. But this, of course, all comes after the Cannon Mills textile plant. And the history of the town is really fascinating. It was a textile mill town for 100 years, and people went to work there every day. Generations worked at the mill. And so when it closed in 2003, it was really devastating for the town. In fact, a woman told me people lost their homes, they lost their cars, some people even lost their minds. That experience kind of shaped what came next, and the attitude and the real sense of hope that people have for the future with the new project. And something else that happened in 2003 when the mill closed would come to be very critical for the town's future, and that is that the human genome was fully sequenced in 2003. So these two things both happened in that year, and they would both shape the future of the town.
Well, tell us how. What happened? Of course, you're talking about 4,300 people in one day suddenly lose their jobs. So that's catastrophic to a town like Kannapolis. What happened then? How is it converted, and what's going to happen next?
So then a man, a billionaire from California, as you mentioned, he actually used to own the mill in the 1980s. His name is David H. Murdoch. He's the chairman of Dole Food Company. It's one of the largest fruit and vegetable companies in the world. He bought the mill back and announced plans for a life sciences complex, and actually worked together with state leaders to encourage different entities in the state to come and lease space on the campus, which, of course, it's a real estate project. And people got on board. And now there are 16 different entities, 8 universities, and they're looking at metabolism, nutrition, the building blocks of life itself. So.
All right. And as you say, there are multiple stakeholders here, so it's not all one entity, but it is mostly in the biotech industry. Is that right?
That's right. It's all looking at kind of data that comes out of individuals participating in different types of research, and then kind of mining that data and asking what kind of patterns emerge, what kind of information can we get that might reveal indicators about patterns of disease, markers. So really a huge emphasis on data, and that's a much larger trend. So in this way, the town's really connected to a larger economy that some people have called the bioeconomy.
And what is the biobank? Is that owned by any one of these entities, or is this generally speaking all of the data that's being collected in this facility?
Well, it's part of one research study that's going on here in this town in North Carolina, and it is specifically focused on chronic disease. It's being carried out by one entity on the campus, which is a research institute associated with Duke University. And it was actually launched with a $35 million gift from David H. Murdoch himself. He's always been interested in disease, nutrition, and especially longevity. So why do some people live much longer than others? And so that's actually one of the questions that this research is focusing on.
All right. So tell us how then the samples are being obtained at this Kannapolis plant.
Well, there's a large recruitment effort underway, and people hear about it through friends, family. They have to be 18 or older to participate, and they must live within a circumscribed area of the town, so zip codes that are in this certain area, and they spend about 30 to 45 minutes. They give their personal health history. They also sign a informed consent form that says that they agreed that their samples can be stored indefinitely for the future in this facility. It's called a biobank. They're very new facilities, and it's a new type of research. And that's what makes it very exciting, very new, and also kind of with a lot of uncertainty. There are a lot of questions that surround it.
A lot of questions. I want to get to some of those, but I want to get a sense of how many people have participated so far in and around Kannapolis.
So far, about 10,000, maybe, a bit more than that. So, and then from each of these people, there are many different types of things that come from their contribution of 3 tablespoons of blood and a urine sample. They can get DNA, RNA, buffy coat, so lots of different materials, very, very valuable and very, very rich materials.
10,000 so far, and I think what's the goal?
So the goal is 50,000 people, which is about a third of the population of this town and a neighboring county. And these numbers are actually pretty in line with other biobanks around the country, which aim towards getting 50,000, 100,000. The greater the numbers, the more data there is. And this data grows more valuable over time as information from people's electronic health records or yearly surveys is added to the biobank.
We are talking about the conversion of a textile mill to a biobank in Kannapolis. That conversation is happening right here on The State of Things. Amanda Wilson is a reporter who looked at that conversion. And right now, as you say, 10,000 people involved. And it is raising some questions about what happens to that. First of all, let's talk about the information they're giving. Their names are stripped. Some identifying markers are taken away, although their whole history is part of this. What is and what is not included with the contribution that folks are making?
Well, what goes into the biobank is the sample that people contribute and electronic. They agree that their electronic health records can also kind of add to this portrait of their, you know, the state of their health and their genome. But every person gets a 6-digit number. And so their names are removed and only very few people have access to that code. According to all the regulatory standards, the samples are de-identified.
So the issues now involved, again, you're talking about giving consent in perpetuity. It's hard to know what perpetuity is when you sign a document like that and what that means, particularly given the way technology could change and the way these things could be used in unimaginable ways down the line. Is this raising concerns in and around the scientific community and in the Kannapolis area?
Well, I think there are definitely concerns, and some of those are being raised by bioethicists. Others are raised by people who have kind of observed the town throughout history and wondering how much people really understand about this very, very, very new field of research in which materials do go into biobanks. They are stored indefinitely for an unknown future, and the most kind of revered standards for protecting participants of research were designed after World War II for research studies in which participants knew the exact nature, purpose, and duration. So biobanks, I think, number one, raise that issue of what does it mean to give informed consent for an unknown future in which technology could change the way that people's genetic information could change. And then the other idea is that samples have DNA. So no matter what you do to them, whether they're attached to a code or even delinked totally from any code in a process that's called de-identification, they can still be linked to the person who gave them. But right now, the regulatory and federal frameworks see de-identification as a way to totally delink. But rulemakers in 2011 released a document that said, you know, we acknowledge that anything with genetic materials can't really be totally delinked from the person who gave it.
And as you pointed out at the top of the show, people are given a sort of a nominal compensation. I think it's a $10 gift certificate to Walmart in compensation for their time. So they're not really being paid for their sample. There is this kind of exchange that goes on. Why do people say they're doing this?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that's a question at the heart of what bioethicists want to know. Because when you answer that, you can really create a system that returns to people what they expect. But here, people expect different things. Some people would like to see economic benefit for their community or public health benefit for future generations. And some people just want to improve the health of the world, which is one of the ideas. And people give for many, many different reasons. But I think one of the main points that bioethicists make is that people do give because they would like to see something in return.
Well, Amanda, thank you very much for your reporting and for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Amanda Wilson, a freelance reporter. You can find a link to her article at our website, stateofthings.org. Her work is a project that was supported by the Investigative Fund and the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Just ahead on The State of Things, the naked truth about nude art. You will hear it here on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Do stay with us.